Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Vlad Everett of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, who discusses the failure of Congress to strengthen gun laws in the wake of the latest tragic mass shooting in Orlando, Florida. Sarah Warbelow of Human Rights Campaign, who examines the massacre at Orlando's Pulse nightclub in the context of an ongoing epidemic of hate crimes targeting members of the LGBTQ community across the U.S. And Dixon Osborne of the Center for Justice and Accountability, who talks about a civil lawsuit seeking justice in a U.S. court for the 1973 murder of Chilean singer and activist Victor Jara. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Human rights groups are outraged that the United Nations has taken Saudi Arabia off a blacklist for violating children's human rights in Yemen, where the oil-rich kingdom is battling Houthi rebels. In early June, a UN report blasted the Saudi coalition in Yemen for 510 child deaths and 667 injuries, and placed the blame for 142 child deaths and 247 injuries on Houthi rebels. Both sides were condemned for attacks on schools and hospitals. Amnesty International decried blatant pandering, which it said damages the credibility of the UN as a whole. Oxfam said the world body's decision to retract its findings was a moral failure. For years, the Houthis, the Yemen government, and pro-government militias have been on the blacklist for violating children's rights. But a move to add Saudi Arabia to the blacklist created a huge backlash as Saudi leaders and their allies mounted a successful pressure campaign on UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. The British government stated it's investigating allegations that UK-manufactured cluster bombs have been used in Saudi attacks. Oxfam said the UN report was yet more evidence that countries such as Britain and the US should halt reckless arms sales to all participants in the conflict. During President Barack Obama's 7.5 years in office, the U.S. has deported roughly 2.5 million people, a record. That's a 23% increase over the previous George W. Bush administration. Despite a stated priority to largely focus on criminals, the government cast a wide net starting in 2008. According to Alejandra Castaneda, coordinator for the Observatory on Immigration Legislation and Policies at the College of the Northern Border in Tijuana, Mexico, the U.S. border enforcement focus wasn't just on people near the border or people trying to cross, but undocumented immigrants in the interior of the U.S. who may have had years or decades of living there, established lives with children and no criminal record. The mass deportations have created a trail of separated families, with U.S. resident children, or so-called Dreamers, protected from deportation by the Obama administration's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, living without one or both parents. According to the Christian Science Monitor, between 740,000 and 925,000 parents of U.S. resident children have been deported, mostly to Mexico and Central America, between 2003 and 2013. The city of Portland, Maine, raised their minimum wage to $10.10 an hour in January, boosting the pay of low-income workers. However, the state of Maine's minimum wage remains at $7.50. When Portland first moved to increase their municipal minimum wage in 2014, $10.10 an hour was a big deal. But in the last 2 years, states including New York and California have adopted a $15 an hour minimum wage. In 2017, Portland's minimum wage rises to $10.68. Subsequent increases will be indexed to inflation. Economists point out that a lack of indexing is why the federal minimum wage is so low. Its peak in terms of purchasing power nationally was in 1968. Maine's voters will cast ballots in November to decide whether or not to raise the state minimum wage to $12 an hour by 2020, which is when it would begin to be indexed to the state's Consumer Price Index. A coalition of business groups allied with Maine's unpopular conservative Tea Party governor, Paul LePage, has lobbied lawmakers to introduce an alternative proposal for a phased-in $10 minimum wage minus automatic indexing. But advocates say higher wages alleviate poverty for workers trapped in low-paid sectors and boost morale and reduce staff turnover, saving employers money. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
In the aftermath of the mass murder of 49 and injuries to more than 50 others at an Orlando, Florida LGBTQ nightclub, the U.S. is again debating the need for stronger gun regulations. The worst mass shooting incident in U.S. history motivated Connecticut Democratic U.S. Senator Chris Murphy to launch a 15-hour filibuster that succeeded in scheduling a vote on several key gun control measures on June 20th. But like so many times before, Republicans, backed by the NRA, voted to block the most effective legislative proposals designed to make the nation's background check system more comprehensive and prevent individuals on the government's terrorist watch list from purchasing firearms. Despite overwhelming support for these bills, GOP politicians and a handful of conservative Democrats continue to oppose virtually all initiatives to reduce gun violence. A recent poll conducted by CNN ORC found 92% of Americans say they want expanded background checks, while 85% say they favor banning people on federal watch lists from buying firearms. The deadly epidemic of 30,000 gun-related murders and suicides that occur each year in the U.S. are among the highest per capita in the world. Your reporter spoke with Ladd Everett, Director of Communications with the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, who talks about the slow but steady progress he sees in mounting public pressure on Congress to enact basic gun safety regulations.
I think we've always known, even going into this vote, that there's going to have to be, I guess, what you would call some regime change in Congress before we can really move forward aggressively with reform. But I'm very confident that we're going to do that. One really, really important thing that's come out of all this is we are going to get the full buy-in of the LGBTQ movement moving forward on gun violence prevention measures. Many people might have seen George Takei's great piece in the Daily Beast the other night, where he was full-throatedly arguing for LGBTQ involvement in this issue. That's going to make a humongous difference from us. And you can only imagine, I mean, there's a lot of people, undoubtedly, probably mostly in Orlando and Florida, who are really aggravated that we couldn't even do something simple like prohibiting suspected terrorists like the Orlando shooter from buying guns. So I think this is going to come back to bite them in a big way, and I am very confident at this point, moving into November, that many of these politicians are going to pay a price. When Kelly Ayotte spoke on the floor today before the votes, she looked pale as a ghost and was clearly nervous. She was trying to lay out a case for why she was going to vote the way she's going to vote, but she knows she is going to take a beating on this in New Hampshire when she's up in November. So, you know, this is a long game. This is not a short game. For those who lack patience or lack a sense of history of how change comes in this country, you're probably going to be pretty frustrated. But I feel very good about where we are after this terrible shooting. There was real movement, even in the Republican ranks, particularly with the way Donald Trump responded about the terrorist watch list issue. He moved the NRA on the issue. Republicans are clearly more skittish than they've ever been. You could see that by the mere fact that they were willing to allow votes so quickly. But I think, you know, their hope now obviously will be, you know, we're getting pounded with calls now. Let's have these votes. Hopefully it'll die off. I think what they're going to find out, if it's not going to die off, is that we are going to stay red hot going up until November, and then there's going to be some very contested races, and I think this issue will play a huge role in them.
Ladd, I wanted to ask you about Maine Republican Senator Susan Collins and a compromise proposal that she was talking about late last week that included using the no-fly list as opposed to the terrorist watch list to prohibit sales of firearms to those individuals. What do you make of her proposal as a compromise? Is it credible?
I think it is credible, yeah. It'll be very interesting to see where this goes from here. For those who, you know, just think as a knee-jerk that we've had our votes and we're not going to get any more votes, I wouldn't be so quick to say that right now. It's possible that Senator Collins and Senator Heitkamp, who was working with her on those compromise measures, could step forward and keep developing their proposal, and we could have an additional vote on that measure. But I appreciate Senator Collins and Senator Heitkamp working on that. I will say that Senator Heitkamp's two no votes on the good bills today were very disappointing, and I think that's going to cost her dearly. But that said, I think that's going to be a motivation for her to want to continue to work on that compromise and maybe get a vote on it. So, we'll see how this plays out, but it would not surprise me in the least if, unlike Newtown, this vote is the beginning of a process as opposed to the end of a process.
So many politicians who are voting with the National Rifle Association and getting their money for their campaign contributions have for years appeared to be insulated against public accountability for their votes in Congress that go against public opinion. But has it really come down to gerrymandered districts? It's just hard to imagine why these folks continue to be so insulated from any kind of accountability.
Yeah, I don't think that's a permanent feature of our politics. You know, it's not as if Democrats can't retake these chambers of Congress. You know, the Senate is certainly in play, very much in play in November, and I think a lot of people now feel that the House is as well. Republicans have a presidential candidate who, probably unstable is a good way to describe him, where, you know, who knows what's going to happen between now and November that could affect voting down ticket from the president. And long term, looking forward, the demographic and cultural changes in this nation do not favor Republicans, and they certainly don't favor a radical Republican Party. So, look, I think the Republicans are trying to milk this reactionary wave as much as they can of, certain white Americans who feel downtrodden or feel like they're losing their privilege in society. But again, I don't think that's a long-term strategy for organizing. I think it has some short-term benefits, but I think long-term it's a failed strategy that's not going to work.
That was Ladd Everett, Director of Communications with the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Learn more about the campaign to enact common sense gun regulations by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After the carnage at Orlando's Pulse nightclub that killed 49 and wounded 53 on June 12th, Americans are reflecting on many issues related to the bloodbath there. Issues being debated include the threat of terrorism, religious extremism, gun control, and hate crimes targeting the LGBTQ community. While the motivation of the Orlando mass murderer may never be fully known, given the contradictory statements and behavior of the perpetrator, the targeting of gays and lesbians for violence is a familiar fact of life in the U.S. According to the most recent FBI statistics available, more than 20% of hate crimes reported nationally in 2014 targeted people based on their sexual orientation or gender identity. However, advocacy groups say these numbers dramatically undercount incidents involving the LGBTQ community, as they are based on local non-mandatory reporting. Further, statistics on murders and crimes against transgender people are especially unreliable, as many attacks are miscategorized or go unreported. The serious problem of homophobia can be seen in the statements made by several conservative Christian churches across the U.S. after the Orlando mass shooting, which praised the murders of gays and lesbians there. One pastor in Sacramento, California, lamented that more didn't die. Your reporter spoke with Sarah Warbelow, legal director with the group Human Rights Campaign. Here she discusses the tragic mass shooting in Orlando in the context of the ongoing epidemic of hate crimes targeting members of the LGBTQ community across the U.S.
First and foremost, you know, we really do want to remind Americans that it was the LGBTQ community that was targeted. This was not a random act of violence. The perpetrator, though we may never know his exact motives, made it clear that he was staking out and seeking LGBTQ people as the victim of his crime. And so we want to continue to educate the American public about the harms that occur when we have Americans who spew hate towards the LGBT community. And sometimes that hate is very much at the forefront and the focus. There are clear messages that LGBT people are sinners who are not deserving of the full American dream. But it's also those more than 200 pieces of legislation that have been introduced in more than 30 states across the country designed to undermine the rights of LGBTQ people. When we send messages of intolerance and hate, it's hardly surprising that someone who was predisposed to violence would select the LGBT community as the target of a hateful attack. So we're really committed to changing the rhetoric and the policies that are being introduced in legislatures from coast to coast. The second thing we're doing is we're really focusing on hate crimes against LGBTQ people. Currently, 20% of all hate crimes are motivated by the victim's sexual orientation or gender identity, according to the latest hate crime statistics collected by the FBI. That's a huge number, second only to hate crimes committed on the basis of race. And when you consider the relatively small number of people that are LGBTQ in this community, we're talking about a disproportionate level of violence against the LGBT community. And then finally, you know, in an area that has been relatively new for the Human Rights Campaign, we are taking on the issue of gun violence protection. We know that the vast majority of Americans support solutions that are a common sense balance between the needs and rights under the Second Amendment and coming up with solutions that decrease the level of violence nationwide.
Sarah, what kind of hate crimes are committed across this country that don't get a great deal of attention from our news media, unlike this horrendous massacre of 49 people in Orlando, Florida?
In 2015, there were a very significant number of transgender women who were murdered in this country. These were individual murders, so rather than an instance of mass violence. But added up, we saw over 20 women who had their lives ended simply because the perpetrator of the violence could not tolerate that they were living their lives with an understanding of who they were, that their gender identity didn't match the sex assigned to them at birth, didn't correspond with who they understood themselves to be, and for their courage in living out their truth, their lives were horrendously ended. And I want to note, too, that many of these hate crimes are committed against people of color. Virtually all of those trans women who were murdered last year were women of color. And if we look at the incident that happened in Orlando, the vast majority of the individuals who were murdered were Latino or Latina.
In the aftermath of the Orlando massacre, we heard from conservative politicians, including the presumptive GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump and some other right-wing commentators, that they're now reaching out to the gay community, making the case that they are allies and can protect the community from hate crimes, including that emanating from religious extremists in the Islamic community. What do you make of that?
Sadly, I think that many of these politicians are being opportunistic. They're utilizing an incredibly tragic event to meet their own political goals. These are politicians who supposedly are offering an olive branch to the LGBT community, but have supported nominating justices to the Supreme Court that would undermine marriage equality, who have supported the so-called First Amendment Defense Act, which would allow for rampant discrimination against LGBTQ people by government actors and recipients of government funds. These are individuals who will not take a stand in support of ensuring that our civil rights laws provide the full protections needed for LGBTQ people in housing, public accommodations, even in jury service. So to think that all of a sudden they are the individuals who will be the saviors of the LGBT community is really just despicable.
That was Sarah Warbelow, Legal Director with Human Rights Campaign. Find more information on how the LGBTQ community is combating hate crimes by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In addition to the infamous terrorist attacks in the U.S. on September 11, 2001, another September 11th in 1973 is a day that will live in infamy. That was the day that Chilean General Augusto Pinochet overthrew the government of Socialist President Salvador Allende. Allende, in his short time in office, had greatly improved the lives of Chile's poor and provided hope for a more equal society. Chilean singer-songwriter Victor Jara was the best-known popularizer of his nation's politics of hope and social justice. Beloved in his own country, he was well-known around the Americas for his beautiful songs that captured Chile's spirit of optimism during that era. Jara was one of thousands of Chileans rounded up after the U.S.-supported military coup and held prisoner in the National Stadium in Santiago. He was later tortured and shot to death. His body was later found with 44 bullet wounds. A civil lawsuit against former Chilean military officer Pedro Pablo Barrientos Núñez for the murder of Victor Jara is now moving forward in an Orlando, Florida court. Barrientos came to the U.S. in 1989 and is a U.S. citizen through marriage. The case, brought under the Alien Tort Statute and Torture Victim Protection Act, marks the first time an officer from the Chilean army will appear as a defendant in a U.S. courtroom to account for Jara's death. The complaint seeks unspecified damages for torture and extrajudicial killing. A parallel case filed in Chile has been moving very slowly through the court system there. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Dixon Osborne, executive director of the Center for Justice and Accountability, the group which filed the suit against Barrientos in September 2013, on behalf of the Jara family. Here he talks about why the case is being pursued in the U.S. and the best outcome for the plaintiffs and justice.
Joan Jara, the widow of Victor Jara, has been pursuing justice for the torture and murder of her husband for 43 years. The reason she has filed a civil lawsuit in the United States and why that trial is happening right now is because the person responsible for her husband's torture and murder has been living in the United States for the last 20 years. The civil statutes in the United States that allows individuals to pursue civil liability for people who've engaged in torture and extrajudicial killing. So the person living here is former lieutenant under Pinochet, Pedro Pablo Núñez Barrientos, and that is a civil trial that's going on now. She has tried to file claims in Chile. While Pinochet remained in power, those claims were barred. Now that he's no longer in power, the investigation has taken a long time and nothing has moved yet to trial. So the significance of the case in Orlando right now is that this is the first trial to try to hold somebody accountable for the torture and murder of Victor Jara.
What do you have to prove to show that Barrientos is liable for the death of Victor Jara?
We're proving two different things. One is that Barrientos is the trigger man. He's the one who actually shot Victor Jara, that killed him, and that he tortured him before that. In the alternative, and at the very least, Barrientos aided and abetted in the torture and murder of Victor Jara. In this civil trial, what we have to show is that it is more likely than not that Barrientos did do what we claim he has done.
Dixon Osborne, just the fact that Barrientos was in charge of what was going on in the stadium, could that fact alone be enough to convict him of these charges?
The level of responsibility, the duties that he had in the stadium, certainly point to a conclusion. We think that he was responsible for the torture and murder of Victor Jara. You have one of the conscripts who testified this week who said that Barrientos is the one who was in charge. You have another conscript saying that he was carrying official orders back and forth between the stadium and the military command center. He clearly exercised significant control and responsibility for the events that took place at Chile Stadium, which is where the Pinochet regime took prisoners in the immediate aftermath of the coup.
What would be the best outcome for the plaintiffs in this case?
Well, the outcome that we're looking for in this case is for a jury of peers to determine that Barrientos is liable for the torture and murder of Victor Jara. Not only does that finally bring resolution and accountability to this case that's been lingering for 43 years, but more importantly, I think it speaks to the people of Chile who have been looking for accountability in this case. Victor Jara is perhaps the most symbolic murder that occurred under the Pinochet regime, because Victor Jara was such an iconic figure there. For the listeners who don't know Victor Jara, he was an iconic folk singer who has inspired people from Bono to Joan Baez.
Is there a possibility he could be extradited back to Chile, or is that not possible, or don't you even care about that?
Yeah, in terms of the civil case, what we're looking for right now and are really focused on is this case. Now, what happens after that is going to be up to the government of Chile and the government of the United States. So it's hard to predict.
That was Dixon Osborne, Executive Director of the Center for Justice and Accountability, which seeks justice for human rights violations across Latin America. For more information on the Victor Jara case and the Center's work, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.